Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. You Catholic girls start much too late. All the sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well will be the one. Well, they showed you a statue, told you to pray. They built you a temple and locked you away. Ah, but they never told you the price that you pay. The things that you might have done. Only the good die.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Michael Wald, and you're listening to Ask the Blood Detective. I'm so excited about today's show because, again, I'm flooded with emails and phone calls from you, the listening audience, about what you want to hear. And many of you wanted to know how and why nutrient needs are different for adults and children, for example, as compared to those with sickness and illness. So we're going to talk about the particulars of how vitamin levels or optimal dosing is even determined. We'll talk about the special nutritional needs of vegetarians and vegans on today's show. I'll even talk about how food and supplement forms of nutrients differ. So that, of course, involves a conversation about synthetic nutrients versus natural vitamins. And listen, you're going to want to stick around for this concept because it's not as simple as thinking that natural is better than synthetic, at least not in every case. And then I'll speak about what are known as provitamins or activated forms of nutrients, because you've heard the saying, you know, you are what you eat. But as I've said so many times on so many of the shows I've done, I take it a step further. Not only are you not what you eat, and you are really not even what you absorb from what you eat. To take it a final step, maybe not a final step, but a further step, you're also what your body activates. So you eat, you absorb, and you activate. These three distinctions are very important when choosing what nutrients or foods to take, because certain foods have activated forms of some nutrients. But many foods actually don't. Your body has to take the foodstuffs in. Foodstuffs are protein, carbs, and fats, and their associated vitamins and minerals. And then your intestinal tract and your liver in particular has the job of activating the nutrients. And of course, if you're not digesting normally, you cannot break apart. You cannot, what is known as cleave, nutrients like vitamins and minerals from foods. Once they're cleaved and once they're separate, we'll talk about some of the dynamic processes in the body that your body undergoes or puts these cleaved nutrients through so that they're usable by the body. I'm going to speak about today whole food supplements, extremely important topic for general health and well-being. And a whole slew of other very, very practical concepts that you need to know whether or not you're a food faddist, meaning you want to do everything through clean diet, that's wonderful, or whether you believe in the addition of various nutrients to your diet or a combination. So either way, this radio show is for you. So everything you want to know about vitamins and minerals and whole foods, we're going to talk about it here today, at least in the next hour. It's going to get you started on the road to a whole other level of health. You know, what's interesting is that the guidelines, the government guidelines regarding nutrient recommendations for children, men and women, for example, and older individuals are basically determined by estimates of intake of different nutrients and age. So it's just averages of estimates of intake of nutrition and age. That's what the government uses by and large to determine how much of this or that nutrient an individual should have along their growth cycle or their aging cycle from birth to death. So, you know, common sense would tell us that in that rapid growth that you'd see in an adolescent would account for a higher recommendation of a various nutrient than in adulthood. For instance, the recommended daily allowance for calcium is the highest, about 1,300 milligrams is the recommendation, the dietary recommendation of how much calcium adolescent boys and girls around 18 years or so of age require. And at the low end of the spectrum, no less than about 1,000 milligrams. But then later on in the aging process or maturity, there's an increase in calcium to about 1,200 milligrams after the age of 50 in women and 70 in men. So let's speak practically. Remember, I opened up the show by saying, you are not what you eat, you're what you absorb. You're not merely what you absorb, you are what you activate from what you absorb. Let's talk about calcium. If you just take calcium in supplements or foods, and whether the supplements are synthetic or natural, that's beside the point for a moment. A person requires normal stomach acid to activate calcium. That activation process is called ionization. Now, most individuals, about approximately 60% of individuals over the age of 50, are calcium insufficient. Now, I didn't say calcium deficient. Deficient would mean that on a blood test, you'd see low calcium. By the way, folks, that rarely happens, even in severe osteoporosis. You know, osteoporosis, or bone softening, is based upon either a radiation scan of your bones, called a DEXA scan, or I use in my office a non-radiation sonogram, which uses sound waves to determine bone density. But regardless of the method used, that's how you figure out loss of bone, not blood levels. Now, what am I getting at? Well, if most individuals over age 50 have low or no stomach acid, they eat all these calcium foods, they take all these natural calcium supplements, and if the body cannot ionize the calcium is not quite the right molecule. The body just doesn't know how to handle it. So it sticks that calcium in different places in the body. It might stick it on the inside of blood vessels, hardening arteries, contributing to atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries, and of course any associated cardiovascular disease associated with hardening of the arteries, like hypertension, which can lead to stroke, among other things. The body also takes that inadequately activated calcium and it can stick it in breast tissue or even in other tissues and causing hardening of the tissues. But in breast tissue, we call that calcium-laden breast cysts. Now, there are many women out there listening to this that know very well that the presence of calcium accumulation in the breast is a very strong predisposing factor to breast cancer. Now, when a mammography is done and the doctor or the technician sees calcium in the breast tissue, they will tend, the doctor will, that is, will recommend tagging it and then looking at it in around 6 months, because 6 months is the doubling time of breast cancer, seeing if that tag they put in there shifts and moves. Now, what you'd want to do nutritionally, among other things, is you'd want to fix your low stomach acid, of which bone loss, hardening of the arteries, and calcium in breast cysts or breast tissue is an indirect sign of. Another sign of calcium insufficiency or improper activation of calcium is arthritis. Think about this. If you don't activate calcium properly, it's not used well. Your body says, hey, what do I do with it? I stick it in the arteries, I stick it in the joints causing arthritis, I stick it in the breast tissue, I stick it in blood vessels. And there is a known medical association. That is a holistic association. All of those health problems I just mentioned, most, are dealt with by at least two different or possibly three different types of physicians, because medicine just isn't set up to see things holistically. So here's my point. Here's my practical point. It's one thing to use a naturally balanced form of calcium, like I produce a form of calcium. It's on the Blood Detective website. But you must consider taking stomach acid with your calcium. Otherwise, you will not activate that calcium and you can cause more health problems. And by the way, if you're taking pH augmented water, in other words, alkaline water, you are literally consuming antacid every time you drink that, assuming that alkaline water is actually alkaline. The alkaline will dilute stomach acid. That's not what you want. Then you have an alkaline environment in your stomach, which you do not want. And then you get overgrowth of bacteria there. And then that situation in the stomach offsets the rest of the function potentially of the entire digestive tract. So if you're too alkaline in your stomach, that offsets all of the neurohormonal reflexes that can cause all kinds of digestive problems, not to mention continuing to adversely affect your activation of other nutrients. We also need stomach acid, by the way, since we're on the topic, to activate iron. So for those women out there in particular who go through menses, menstruation, the body must extract and activate with the use of stomach acid iron in the stomach. If you take iron and you do not have proper stomach acid, you can predispose yourself to iron accumulation. And iron accumulation, there's two conditions of iron accumulation. There's hemochromatosis, which is a genetically caused condition where the body accumulates too much iron. It increases the risk of renal or kidney failure, all kinds of cardiovascular problems. But if you acquire low stomach acid, which happens to most individuals, as I mentioned, that are age 50 and above, then you could predispose yourself to an acquired form of iron accumulation called hemosiderosis. Now, as the self-prescribed blood detective, I can tell you, and everyone out there also being your own blood detectives, if you look at a blood test, you'd want to ask your doctor to measure something called serum iron, which tells you the level of iron in your serum, but you cannot stop there. You want to know if your body's been adversely or abnormally, that is, storing iron. And the storage test of iron overload is ferritin. Ferritin elevations can mean two things. Number one, as I have just been describing, that because of lack of stomach acid, or your stomach acid could be fine, you could just be taking too much iron. That's probably a more common cause of iron accumulation, and it's not uncommon. I've seen it. You will have a high serum iron and a high ferritin. There are some other lab findings associated with it, but a little bit too detailed, even for this show today. Now, high ferritin, and ferritin itself, is one of the most predictive laboratory tests that a person could do for various disease predispositions. Now, let me make something super, super clear. High ferritin or iron accumulation can be caused by poor utilization of iron because of low stomach acid. It can be caused by taking too much iron supplements. It'll almost never be caused by eating too much iron-containing foods, particularly if they're plant foods, because plants do contain iron, as you know, like dark green leafy veggies. But the iron in plants is a specific type of iron, and that iron is called non-heme iron. It's not very well absorbed at all. If you increase your vitamin C intake in your diet at the time you eat these dark green leafy vegetable plants, you will convert that not so well absorbed, not very well activated, right? We're talking about nutrient activation as part of the show. We've talked about calcium activation. Now we're talking about iron activation. Iron accumulation is a serious problem. Too much iron can predispose to oxidation, which can predispose to various cancers, like colon cancer, but also to heart disease. But don't make this mistake. I've worked with some people that I've found them as being iron anemic. That means deficient in iron. Before you supplement with iron, you always must find out and identify the reason for that iron anemia, because particularly when a person becomes an older adult, the cause of anemia might be internal bleeding, like from hemorrhoids, for example, or from pathological processes. And if you keep taking iron, you can mask that problem. So chronic iron anemia should be very well investigated. And as I was saying, ferritin blood testing is one of the most predictive blood tests a person can do to offset disease risk. Meaning, if it's high, if your ferritin is high and you lower it, you've probably reduced your overall morbidity and mortality. There is one other important reason I have not made clear that can be a cause of high ferritin. And this cause is the entire topic of my next show, inflammation. Now, most individuals out there listening to Ask the Blood Detective right now are well aware that inflammation is a fundamental process that's involved in virtually all human disease and dysfunction. Except there are many causes of inflammation. And if one really wants to manage the aging process, reduce risk of disease, improve quality of life, is to identify the forms of inflammation and target them nutritionally. So for example, if you have a high ferritin and it is not caused by iron accumulation, it's actually caused by inflammation. Inflammation will raise ferritin too. It will also do it, even if you're not iron toxic. So if you didn't know that, you couldn't correct that inflammation. Another cause of inflammation might be vitamin E and lipoic acid deficiency. Those deficiencies could cause a certain type of inflammation that you can test on the blood test, write this down, as an elevated C-reactive protein, or cardio-CRP. Now, there are several other causes of elevations of C-reactive protein. Now, by the way, these are tests that are super important for longevity and quality of life. If you haven't had a C-reactive protein done, you haven't had a ferritin done, and you have not had, listen carefully, please, an ionized calcium done, something's wrong. Your doctor is not up on his or her stuff. It's up to you, as individual blood detectives, to advocate for yourself, request certain tests. So when I started off in the show by talking about the guidelines of nutrient recommendations by the United States government, the recommended daily allowances, and I mentioned that they're basically determined by estimates of intake and age, they're not at all estimated in terms of need based on your individual malabsorption. Maybe you have low stomach acid, or maybe you have inflammation or other health issues or certain genetic problems or take certain medications or are of a certain level of fitness. So many other factors, genetics, toxic exposure, can affect and do affect our nutrient needs, your nutrient needs. So when a patient says to me, Dr. Wald, I took your recommendations to my primary healthcare provider, and he said that I don't need any of these nutrients. And I would say, well, what did he or she tell you? Where did that come from? And very often I hear the following. Oh, Dr. Wald, they said that these levels are far higher than the recommended daily allowances, and that the RDAs are what I need. This is too much. I said, yes, but your laboratory work shows that you malabsorb. You don't have enough stomach acid, or you don't have enough enzymes. You're not ionizing your calcium. Your intake tells us nothing, I say, about your activation and utilization and use of these nutrients. And I usually get a very odd look back until, I give some educational materials where I help the individual to understand what I'm talking about now, the processes behind all this. So you can say to your doctor, well, I thought that recommended daily allowances were just based on average intakes of certain population groups and age. What does that have to do with my needs, doctor? And then the doctor will be astounded at that response and usually gets upset. I wanted to digress for a moment in that I received a question. It was a good question. The question was, Dr. Wald, does iron anemia, calcium misuse, which is what we've been talking about, have anything to do with chronic musculoskeletal symptoms, nerve symptoms, muscle aches, pain, joint problems? The answer is yes. If you are iron anemic, you are not going to produce enough hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is the protein in the blood, in the red blood cell, that allows the red blood cell to carry oxygen to tissues and to take carbon dioxide away. So if you don't have enough iron or it's misused, then the muscles will not get the oxygenation and you can have aches and pains, inflammation, and breakdown. If you misuse calcium, the body puts excessive calcium also into muscle tissue, causing fibromyalgia type symptoms and all sorts of musculoskeletal pain. Calcium misuse also can create nerve pain and numbness and what are called neuropathies, different types of pain neurologic disorders. So you bet. Also, let's talk about another nutrient, a food group, I should say, protein. Protein requires stomach acid, so the stomach acid breaks down the protein into individual amino acids. And if you don't break them down into individual amino acids, but also, by the way, very important, the stomach does not merely digest proteins into individual aminos, but also some of those amino acids like might stay in groups. Two amino acids might be linked together still from that steak you ate or that tofu or that tempeh you ate. Or three or more amino acids may stay together. They're called di, tri, and polypeptides. And they help to heal different types of tissue. So we need stomach acid for that. But we also need proper enzymes. So stomach acid and enzymes are absolutely required, not just for the proper digestion and assimilation of proteins into individual amino acids, like let's say tryptophan, which the body uses to make serotonin for mood, or the body might keep several proteins together that might heal a muscle tissue or a heart tissue or a thyroid tissue. But we also need proper enzymes. Enzymes help digest protein, carbs, and fats. Now let's digress to the special needs of vegetarians and vegans. You know, there is clearly much to commend about vegetarian and vegan diets, but there are several very important nutrient deficiencies and insufficiencies that are much more common in individuals who choose a vegetarian or vegan lifestyle. And we have to recognize that if we do not pay special attention to correcting these nutrient deficiencies, then a person, a vegan or vegetarian, might end up with some illness that they themselves have induced. So the most common deficiency probably in both vegetarians and vegans is B12, but also vitamin D, the omega-3, what are called long-chain fatty acids, calcium as we've been talking about, iron we've been talking about, zinc, carnitine, and protein. Now, B12 is in many types of plant products, but it is very hard for the body to extract. B12 in the form of meat products is much easier to assimilate. So it makes sense that a vegetarian or vegan may be predisposed to B12 deficiency, but B12 is extracted or cleaved from proteins with stomach acid. And the activation of B12, for it to be used for most functions in the body, requires it to be methylated. So methylated B12 is probably the best, most active form of B12 for its use in the body. Of course, B12 is needed for health of the nervous system and energy production. Those are some of the more common uses of B12, but also red blood cell circulation, meaning the health or integrity of a red blood cell and the proper size of a red blood cell. B12 helps determine that. In fact, B12 anemia can result in something called macrocytic anemia, which is just a fancy term for the red blood cells being very, very big and they don't work as well and they make the blood thick. So methylated B12 is the type of B12 that is most reliably taken, I believe, in the form of a methylated supplement, and preferably a sublingual form, which can bypass digestive blocks by going through the circulation that's under the tongue, known as the venous circulation. Now, another deficiency, another vitamin deficiency associated with both vegan and vegetarian diets is vitamin D3. And we've all learned tons about vitamin D3. A few quick facts. On a blood test, the range is 30 to 100 of vitamin D. But the optimal dose of vitamin D, the amount of vitamin D in the body that's associated with living longer and better, is between 70 and 100. In other words, the higher normal your blood vitamin D level, the better off you are. Most doctors look at the blood and say, oh, well, you're a 40, remember in the 30 to 100 range, or you're a 50, or you're a 60. Well, that's okay, but it's not optimal. A group of studies known as a meta-analysis, which looked at many, many, many different vitamin D studies performed correctly, concluded that the best number is about a 70, and between 70 and 100 is where your vitamin D should be, vitamin D3 should be. When I find low vitamin D on a blood test, which again can lead to everything from cancer to cancers of various types, to cardiovascular disease, to chronic inflammation, even to a worse course of Lyme disease. In other words, low vitamin D levels or inadequate vitamin D is associated with a poorer course in recovery from Lyme disease, not to mention many other infections. Overall, the thing you should know about vitamin D is you should take it only in the form of D3. If your blood level is lower than 30, then the correct management, the correct medical management of that deficiency is, of course, to look at your diet. You may not want to consume fish, which is high in vitamin D, if you're a vegan. That's why the vitamin D supplement in the D3 form is ideal. I would provide my D3 50,000 units once a week for between 4 to 8 weeks, depending on your weight, with a level of vitamin D lower than 30. Now, by the way, it's the liver, the kidneys, and the lungs that turn vitamin D into D3. So sometimes diseases of the liver, the kidneys, or the lungs, or just dysfunctions, could result in improper production in the body of D3. If you're thinking that you're going to expose yourself to sun and fix a clinically low vitamin D on your blood, you can guess again, it won't happen. It just doesn't happen. The wavelengths of light that we need to hit our skin that converts cholesterol in the skin to D3 in those organs is blocked and interfered with by deterioration of our ozone layer. Now, another deficiency of vegan and vegetarian diets, as I mentioned, are omega-3 fatty acids. Now, omega-3 fats are found in non-animal sources, as you might have guessed, in blue-green algae, for example, and also in flaxseed oil and flax seeds. Except flax seeds and their oils are in a form that have to be metabolized. In other words, activated. Remember, that's what this show is about, activation of nutrition. If you eat flax seeds or flaxseed oil, you had better make sure you have proper balance and activation of zinc and biotin and other B vitamins and C, because those nutrients are needed for certain enzymes to work in the body that can turn the flaxseed oil, which is omega 3, 6, and 9, all of that is in flax seeds, to the individual fatty acids that the body can use well. I do not prefer to recommend flaxseed oil to my patients who I determine need more omega-3s. Not that flaxseeds aren't very healthy. They're fine. You want the lignans in them, which bind to estrogens, for example, and cholesterol. That's all good and fine. But if you need omega-3s in significant amounts, if you're concerned about reducing your risk of clotting and heart attack and stroke and cancer and dementia and inflammation and healing in general and health of the nervous system, then you need an activated form of omega-3. I prefer to use a fish-derived form that's purified in the form of what's called DHA. But for those of you out there who just will not have anything from an animal, you could, of course, do the flaxseed and make very sure you have adequate utilization and levels of those other nutrients I mentioned, so you can use the flaxseed oil well to activate the omega-3s. Now, by the way, what's interesting about blue green algae is that the reason why fish like salmon, mackerel, and tuna, for example, are high in omega-3s is because those fish eat the algae. Fish normally would not have any omega-3s in their bodies. That's totally determined by their environment. If the lake or river, for example, or the ocean that the fish live in do not have proper levels of algae, the fish will be deficient. So I prefer, if people are willing, to take DHA in an oil form, because DHA in an oil form also can coat the small intestine. And the small intestine is the site of most nutrient absorption and some nutrient activation in the body. On a related note, it's very important to maintain our liver health whenever we're having a conversation or a desire to improve nutritional use. Remember, folks, you are not what you eat. You are not what you absorb. You are what you activate. So many times I have people come to me and they say, "Dr. Wald, I don't understand. I've been taking all these nutrients." They put up 10 pounds of nutrients on my table. The whole room shakes. And it's not really funny, but I'm trying to stress a point. It's not what you're taking. You must have normal stomach acid. You must have normal enzymes. And I prefer to use purified pharmaceutical grade supplements, some of them in natural forms and some of them that are synthetic, but they are bioidentical to the natural product because I can control the amount of activated nutrient. You could, for example, if someone has dermatitis, inflammation of the skin, those skin changes, that person may need activated biotin and certainly activated omega-3 fats. But if that individual's liver is not working properly, there will not be activation of that biotin, no matter how much biotin that person takes. So it is very confusing, understandably, where people will say, "I don't get it. I've been taking these nutrients. It should work. This company is great." Who said? I always question, who said that company is great? The company could be famous. That doesn't mean that their supplements work. Many individuals also misinterpret how their nutrients that they take work. For example, they might have, a headache or fatigue, and they might take a new nutrient, and in a day or two or three or four or five, they're feeling so much better. And most of the time, that is entirely placebo, because it takes several weeks often to raise blood levels to ideal levels that are even physiologically useful. And if the individual malabsorbs, if they're over 50, oftentimes this is just the body in its positive thinking mode. Once you've really made a change that's lasted over 40 days or thereabouts, that's probably a real improvement. But also we can confirm if someone's feeling much better from a nutrient protocol, changing of diet, improving of diet, maybe including supplements, and abnormal laboratory work improves, then you've got something there that is potentially lasting and not only has improved your immediate sense of well-being, but also may give you a statistical advantage for living better and even living longer and better. That potential is there with nutrient activation. Now, let's move on to food and supplement forms of nutrients and how they differ. So here we'll discuss a few issues that can be, quite contentious within the world of marketing vitamins and minerals. The relative differences and benefits between various forms of vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients is something that is very, very confusing. For example, in a good multivitamin, it might say, well, what you think is a good multivitamin, it might say vitamin B6, or it might say pyridoxal HCl. Now, that is a good form probably for most people, but that's not the best activated form of B6. That activated form would be pyridoxal 5-phosphate, or what we call P5P. So P5P, when you read it in contained in a supplement, is a much better form of B6 than pyridoxine HCl. When looking at calcium, for example, there are different forms of calcium. Many individuals seem to be focused on just the amounts of the vitamins, but the types, whether they're activated forms, as now you recognize, is all important. So calcium carbonate is not nearly as bioavailable and usable in the body as calcium citrate. But neither one of these forms of calcium are very effective if you have insufficient absorption or low stomach acid. So let's talk about synthetic versus natural vitamins. So I think few terms are more loaded with implied meaning in the supplement world as the terms natural and synthetic. And natural forms are almost always viewed as being better than synthetics. Now, many of you out there might be very surprised to learn that nearly all vitamins and minerals used for making dietary supplement processes, products that is, and for food fortification are not natural. They're not strictly natural. They're mostly synthetic. This means that the nutrient, as it's used in either a capsule or a tablet, has been changed in some way from the form found in nature. An example is vitamin C or ascorbic acid. So vitamin C compounds or natural ascorbates are found, as you know, in fruits and vegetables and a variety of foods. And the natural ascorbates are stable when the food source maintains its integrity. Now, ascorbic acid, which is, again, different than natural ascorbates, ascorbic acid, on the other hand, that's made from corn-derived sugars in a multi-step synthetic process. Most people just read ascorbic acid and say, hey, vitamin C. By definition, ascorbic acid is highly synthetic. In the case of vitamin C, the natural ascorbates are generally also found together with compounds known as bioflavonoids, which enhance the health benefits of the vitamin C. They may actually be responsible for most of the health benefits of vitamin C. So for years, we realize now we've incorrectly given vitamin C all the credit, but the bioflavonoids found in nature with vitamin C may be just as or more responsible for the health benefits. You know, what's interesting is that the stomach lining contains what are known as vitamin C pumps. So we've evolutionarily evolved to require vitamin C, which is why we call it a vital amine. It was once thought, the term amine, by the way, refers to proteins or amino acids. So vitamin C has been incorrectly classified as a vitamin. It certainly is vital, but it's not an amine. It's not a protein. There's so many examples in science of these sorts of mistakes that are just never corrected. But if the vitamin C, if you're low in vitamin C, which in my opinion is best determined by a urine test, because if your blood vitamin C levels are normal, even if they're high, if you don't have any vitamin C spilling over into the urine, your body is probably not fully and ideally saturated with vitamin C. I should say, by the way, that, because I get a lot of questions about this, I'm not a fan of ester C. Ester C, in my opinion, is equivalent to a synthetic form of vitamin C. The body naturally stores and utilizes vitamin C in what are known as the water-soluble compartments of the body. Now, ester C is more of a fat-soluble form of vitamin C, and that's just not what nature intended. There were some earlier studies that seemed to suggest there was greater storage in the body of the ester C, and that may be true, because the greater storage might mean that vitamin C is stored in fat tissue, but that is not how the body naturally evolved to use vitamin C. So I'm not a fan of ester C at all. I am a fan of highly buffered ascorbates, which are natural alkalinized forms of vitamin C in a powder form. So my product, which is that, is a detox eliminate, which is a very buffered form of vitamin C. And that, I believe, is the proper form to use to assure that you saturate your tissues with vitamin C. And I generally check the urine levels of vitamin C as well to make sure of a couple of things. Number one, that there is vitamin C present in the urine. Because if it's in the urine, it's fully saturated in the body. Whatever shows up in the urine is the spillover. You get it? Now, we've been talking about nutrient activation, right? Keep coming back to that. How do you know your body's activating vitamin C? Well, a form of inactivated and, relatively speaking, harmful form of vitamin C is called dehydroascorbate. If you have a load of ascorbic acid in the urine, then that means you are not recycling your vitamin C normally. I'm going to say that again. If on a urine sample, you do not have enough vitamin C, that's deficiency or insufficiency. And if you have a chemical in your urine called dehydroascorbic acid, that means your body's under oxidative stress, because that form of vitamin C, the inactivated, evil dehydroascorbic acid, is accumulating too much in the body. Now, sometimes the body will accumulate a lot of dehydroascorbic acid for another reason that is the total opposite to what I just said. Listen to this. The body might oxidize vitamin C, making the form I just mentioned, dehydroascorbic acid, because that form can sometimes be produced when the body has cancer. There's many studies that show if you give someone dehydroascorbic acid, it might help with their cancer. But on the other hand, it could possibly even cause cancer because it is an oxidant. An oxidant can break down a cancer cell, but an oxidant can break down a normal, healthy cell. So how do you know what to do, for goodness sakes? Well, you look at a variety of lab tests. You have a qualified person look at a dietary sample intake over several days of what you're eating and drinking and your exercise and time of day and all of that, and look at your health issues and what medications you may be taking and other health factors, genetics and testing, and you make sure all of that's balanced and considered together in a comprehensive, holistic, thorough, blood detective way. That is how you are a blood detective. You look at a multitude of angles that increase the probability that you're getting the information right and you're interpreting it right. So again, if you look at the blood levels of vitamin C and they're high, you might say, hey, I don't need any more vitamin C. Or, hey, the blood levels of B12 are high. I hear this all the time. A patient will come in all panic. Dr. Wald, my doctor said I'm taking too much B12. My blood levels are super high. It doesn't mean that you're toxic. In fact, it almost never means that. If your blood levels of B12 are high, think of it this way. Imagine a red blood cell in front of your face. And imagine B12 floating around the outside of that red blood cell. And that red blood cell, by the way, could be any tissue in the body. You may have high levels of B12 because it's not in the blood cell or in the tissue you want it to be. So it means quite the opposite of what the doctor might say, you're having too much. Commonly, if a person doesn't activate, did you hear me? If a person doesn't activate that B12, it will accumulate outside of tissues and not get in. But some doctors and even some nutritionists misinterpret blood tests. First of all, with all due respect, nutritionists are not qualified to read blood work unless they have specific professional and postgraduate training generally in that. A dietitian should not be reading blood work except in certain circumstances. And almost every other type of nutritionist does not learn in professional school how to read blood work. It is important, in my opinion, as a blood detective, you know, again, I made that term up or someone gave me that term and I embraced it. I have carefully considered the nutritional interpretation of blood relative to what I like to treat, all sorts of neuromusculoskeletal and nutritional related problems. Let's move on. Another question that I am commonly asked is whether or not I think that a person should just have whole food supplements. So for example, I make 4 whole food supplements. I call them Detox 1, Detox 2, Detox 3, and Detox 4. They are all powders, and one of them is red, purple, orange, and green because of the concentration of the plant products that I've placed within them that I use for different purposes. But very commonly, most every patient I see as a basic dietary support, I place them on my Detox 1, 2, 3, and 4 products. Depending on how much I prescribe to a person, I might induce detoxification, but don't let the name frighten you if you choose to use these products, which they're perfectly safe because they're foods. A half of a scoop, it's a small scoop of each of these products mixed together is a very nice augmentation to even the best diets. When I do my raw juicing every morning, I put my dehydrated powdered Detox 1, 2, 3, 4 scoops right in there. It makes that one juice the nutritional equivalent of a dozen or more. There are tens of thousands of plant elements in there that have all sorts of health potential. And the reason I mention this is because these food products have highly activated forms of nutrients. They're activated forms of nutrients and they're highly concentrated and they taste great. You could eat bowls and plates of fruits and vegetables and you would still not get the concentrated nutrition and activation in these food concentrates. So I'm a big fan of them. Now, the question I hear a lot is, Dr. Wald, okay, I get the health benefits, potential health benefits of superfoods, but what about using a single nutrient? What about carnitine or the amino acid N-acetylcysteine? What about using those single nutrients or any other single nutrient, vitamin E on its own, vitamin C on its own? I am telling you, and I'm asking you to believe me when I say, there is a huge amount of evidence that supports the use of single nutrients in addition to superfoods. For example, if you want to use your omega-3 fats and activate them very well, help activate your flaxseed oil, which is harder to use in the body than a fish-based omega-3, you'd want to take some carnitine with that. Carnitine is a single nutrient. And remember, the question was, Dr. Wald, do single nutrients have health benefits? This isn't a question. There is no question that single nutrients have health benefits. It also does depend on the single nutrient we're talking about, but I spend a lot of my day on the National Institute of Health website, where there are over 6 million scientific and nutritional journal citations, studies, dating back from 1966 to the present. And I'm telling you, there's no way I am imagining all these studies. Not only is there evidence that single nutrients can help where whole foods may not, or at least the combination is better, but nowadays, we can actually get activated forms of these single nutrients. Again, activation. So I use a form of acetyl L-carnitine, which helps the body use fatty acids. Acetylation is the process, an acetyl group is a certain, don't lose me here. Acetylation is the process of attaching an acetyl group to the carnitine. So the carnitine is now called acetyl L-carnitine. That form of carnitine is super used by the body, helps the body push omega-3 fats into the cells where it's needed and into the cell membranes. Everywhere there's a cell membrane in the body, there's omega-3 fats. And I also mentioned another single nutrient, cysteine. Now, cysteine is an amino acid, just like carnitine. But please do not ever use cysteine or L-cysteine, ever. L-cysteine has been shown in studies to bind to mercury in the body and put it in the brain. But another form of cysteine called N-acetylcysteine, that is cysteine that has been acetylated, meaning an acetyl group, a chemical compound, has been linked to it, and it makes it super bioavailable. N-acetylcysteine is also called NAC. I have that as part of my blood detective line at blooddetective.com. And NAC is one of my favorite nutrients ever because, and get this, you can write it down, you can look it up. If you Googled N-acetylcysteine and health benefits, you will come up with scholarly articles on Google. The scholarly articles lead to all these scientific articles, reliable information. There's a lot of wrong information on the web, no doubt. So N-acetylcysteine is antiviral, very strongly antiviral. It increases glutathione levels. Now, glutathione is an immune modifier, immune modulator, that studies have shown that after just 15 minutes of taking N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, N-A-C, the lung and respiratory tract levels of the important immune modulator, glutathione, increase dramatically. It is better to take NAC to make glutathione in the body than to eat glutathione. Because when you eat glutathione, the body just breaks that down into three individual amino acids and it's no longer glutathione. Also, N-acetylcysteine is antibacterial, it's antiparasitic, and it's antifungal. So again, very versatile nutrient, single nutrient, NAC. Another benefit of NAC is that NAC is a mucolytic agent, which means it breaks up mucus. So when you start taking it, you're going to start coughing up all this extra mucus. You're going to say, it's making me worse. No, it's not. It's making the thick mucus much more thin so the body can get it out. NAC also, by the way, is a real detoxifier. What do I mean by real detoxifier? So I'd ask you to go back and listen to my show called Detox Deception, where I blow away all these lies around many so-called natural ways of detoxing. NAC is natural, and it is such a powerful, real detoxifier that even traditional medicine and toxicology acknowledges it. It's in all the textbooks. It's used in the emergency room for acetaminophen toxicity. And N-acetylcysteine is also part of the standard of care for individuals with cystic fibrosis because it breaks up the mucus in the lungs that usually kills these poor individuals suffering from cystic fibrosis from pneumonia. So single nutrients absolutely play a role in health and health maintenance and disease prevention. But as the whole theme of this show has been, we need to have nutrients in the most active or bioavailable forms. Oh, by the way, NAC is not only a detoxifier for acetaminophen toxicity, but the cysteine conjugation pathway. Let me say that again. Cysteine conjugation. Conjugation just means putting something together. So cysteine or N-acetylcysteine puts together various toxins stored in the bottom and puts them together in a way that the body can eliminate them. It's one of the six major true liver detox systems that the body uses to detoxify probably hundreds of different types of toxins. The only thing you need to know about NAC is that if you take it along with zinc or copper, it's such a good chelator. I didn't even mention that effect of NAC. NAC is a chelator, which means it binds to toxins. It's very effective for removing mercury from the body and other heavy metals, but it can also chelate or bind to minerals like zinc. And of course, we need zinc for immunity as well as tissue repair. So sometimes, as you all probably know, the timing of nutrients and the combinations matter. So when it comes to foods and superfood supplements and single activated nutrients, I personally prefer to enhance, of course, and improve the individual's dietary intake, not just in some vague, healthy way, whatever that means, not eating refined and processed foods and not eating GMO foods, eat organically when you can, et cetera, all the basics. But depending on your health goals and your health problems and other factors, there are different types of healthy ways to eat, not just one way. And we cannot assume that if we are vegetarians or vegans, that's necessarily healthier, because there are problems with nutrient deficiencies, as we've talked about during the show, and nutrient activation in vegan and vegetarian diets sometimes. Not all the time. That's why I care about individuals. We have to check it out and correct these things. So what I'm saying here is I clean up the diet based on a number of factors, health history, some laboratory work, food logs, health goals, and I consider single nutrients or combinations of nutrients, vitamins, minerals, herbs, and other types of what are known as nutraceuticals. And I base the dosing on all those things I just mentioned and something I mentioned very often during my shows on Ask the Blood Detective is body composition of muscles, or I should say, I'm sorry, proteins, carbohydrates, and fats, and metabolic rate. So there's what's known as a body composition test or a bioimpedance test that can measure exactly your metabolic rate and what percentage of you is muscle, water, and fat. If you know these factors, you can tailor and personalize a health plan for you that is far, far better than simply eating healthy, whatever that might be for you, and hoping you absorb and activate what it is you're eating. So I hope that this topic gave you something to think about. You should be thinking about nutrient activation. Now, the next show, by the way, is all about inflammation. Now, I'm going to tell you, if you think you know inflammation, think again, because the stuff that I will be discussing with you in practical detail about inflammatory markers, how to measure them, how to fix them, how to tailor nutrients, food, and lifestyle to them, and what health problems are predisposed by certain inflammatory mediators, and how inflammation can kill you, but how inflammation can save you is something you do not want to miss. So please tune in the usual time to Ask the Blood Detective. Everything about inflammation is next. For those of you who would like to submit your topic ideas to me, please do. Email me at info@blooddetective.com. And also go to my website, post your questions on my blog at www.integratednutritionny.com. Integratednutritionny.com. You can call me if you'd like to work with me either by phone or video chat or in person as a patient at 914-242-8844. Thank you so much for joining me. My name is Dr. Michael Wald. It has been a pleasure.
Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. You Catholic girls start much too late. Oh, but sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well be the one. Well, they show you.